find out. Avery frowned. Okay, and when we find out, what are we going to do about it? What is Rubicon Ventures, really?
Rubicon Ventures is a front, one of several used by the Rubicon program. We're a covert organization funded by the U.S. government. Only a few people in government even know we exist. We have one mission, stopping Sishium.
People in government, like, what, CIA?
No. Rubicon isn't run out of any official government organization. We don't have ID cards with a three-letter acronym. No paper trail, no risk of leaks. But every month, seven very highly placed members of our government meet to discuss the Rubicon program. Only they know the truth of our activities. They provide funding and help when needed.
So how do we stop the Sishium?
He smiled. That is the question. I'll tell you the answer when you're ready.
I'm ready now.
No, you're not. Your real training begins today, Avery.
That training took 2 years.
Every Thursday night she drove up to Northern Virginia, to the colonial home in the country, where she learned things that had nothing to do with due diligence. She learned to fire a handgun. She had gone hunting with her father since she was old enough to walk, but she'd had no experience with military firearms. She mastered hand-to-hand fighting. Close-quarters combat was foreign to her, but she picked it up quickly. On some level, it reminded her of tennis. Quick reactions, fending off attacks from opponents, moving her feet, swinging with force. With each passing week, she grew, changed ever so slightly. Her focus became complete. During that time, she continued her work at Rubicon Ventures. Rubicon was making real investments in the Sishium companies, hoping that access would yield more information. Each month, Avery added more data points to the corkboard. Increasingly, those points connected. The Sishium were getting close to completing the looking glass. Finally, she and David sat down in the library and spread out the companies connected to Sishium Holdings. Pick, he said.
Pick what?
An insertion point. You're going to infiltrate the Sishium.
Hughes. He's the key.
Why?
He's different from the rest, she said.
How?
He's a true believer. He's convinced that the looking glass will save humanity. But I don't think he knows the truth about what they're doing. If I can get through to him, we'll have access to everything, and a shot at stopping them.
And if you're wrong, if he does know, he'll kill you.
I'll take that chance.
Good. In the field, you'll have to trust your instincts. Make the right moves, ask the right questions, just like you have been. I won't be around to help you. If you think Hughes is the key, then he's the key.
The next day, Avery applied for a job at Phaethon Genetics, one of Icarus Capital's portfolio companies. Her cover story was that while performing due diligence on Phaethon for her firm, she'd been impressed with their product and technology. She told the interviewer that she believed in the work they were doing, and if she was being completely honest, she thought the company would succeed and become worth a ton of money. She hoped to get in early, get stock options, and cash out when the company was acquired or went public. They hired her a few days later. She was assigned to a programming team within the IT group. She hadn't done any coding since she'd completed her computer science major 3 years before, but she picked it back up quickly. Phaethon was growing fast. The company was collecting genomic data and performing analysis, looking for insights that would help drug companies and healthcare providers make better decisions. They were taking a big data approach to medicine, using a proprietary application that analyzed the genomic data. Their data center was struggling to keep up with the mountains of data the company was bringing in. The company's root problem, however, was communication. The business side of the organization was constantly at war with the scientists, who were at war with the programmers. The scientists didn't move fast enough for the business group, the programmers didn't move fast enough for the scientists, and the programmers were always complaining that they needed more computing capacity to run the simulations. Simulations the business group refused to move to the grid for security purposes. And that created the opportunity Avery needed to move up in the organization. Her background in due diligence, in analyzing hundreds of startup companies' science and business, had given her unique insight into problems like the ones Phaethon was facing. And with her communication skills, she quickly became the IT group's liaison with the scientists and business side. It didn't matter that half the programmers could code circles around her. They were a nightmare in meetings. When at last she was promoted,
It was not because of the skills she'd acquired in college, but rather because of what she'd learned in her time at Rubicon. How to read people, analyze a situation, and help everyone find a solution. And as she'd hoped, her new role increasingly brought her into contact with Desmond Hughes.
"We got closer,"
Avery said over the helicopter's comm. She paused. Desmond sensed that she was holding back. He wondered if Peyton was aware of it too.
"A month ago," Avery said, "you discovered that I was taking data off-site, leaving it at Dead Drops. You thought it was corporate espionage. You confronted me and I took a chance. I told you the truth about the Rubicon program and what we believe the Sishium were doing."
She glanced back at him. "It was news to you, Des. You had seen only pieces of the conspiracy. 2 days later, you called me and told me that you had done your own investigation. You said it was true. The Sishium was planning something unthinkable."
"The pandemic," Desmond said.
"I think so," Avery replied. "You told me that the Sishium had begun with good intentions, that at their core they'd been a noble organization, focused on unraveling the greatest mystery of all time, one at the heart of our existence. In recent years, however, they had lost their way. Hardliners had taken over, changed the agenda. They believed the human race was in danger. The experiments and steps they were willing to take had become more radical. You wanted to stop it. You got me reassigned to the Kentaro Maru. You said it would be the safest place for both of us. You said if your plan failed, you would probably be taken there. I promised to help you if that happened. The next time I saw you was in that cell yesterday."
"So I failed," Desmond said.
"Maybe. I don't think we know enough to say yet. I think your first plan was to expose the Sishium and cause a public uproar, focus media and government attention on them, and collapse the organization in one move. But they must have discovered you. You have one of the pieces of the looking glass. You hid it, or maybe destroyed it. That's why they were so intent on capturing you alive."
Desmond nodded.
"Erasing my memories was a backup plan."
"I think so.
And it stands to reason that somewhere in my memories is the key to stopping the Sishium and the pandemic.
And the key to completing their work," Avery said. "You heard the conversation on the ship, Des? They scanned your body. You've got a specialized implant in your brain, in the hippocampus, where memories are stored. Connor was convinced that implant could unblock memories and that you'd left a back door in a mobile application that would trigger the memories."
She glanced back at him.
"In Berlin, did you find it, the application?"
Peyton turned to him and silently mouthed, "Don't tell her." She obviously didn't trust Avery. But Desmond had found Avery's story very convincing. It explained how she had come to be a Sishium employee, how she had gotten on the Kentaro Maru,
why she had rescued them.
And yet her story lacked something very important. It couldn't be verified. The Rubicon program was strictly off the books, in her words. There was no doubt in his mind she was a special operative of some kind. What he didn't know was whose side she was truly on. What if her mission was to find the application that would unlock his memories? What if her story was just that? A story. He made his decision.
"Yeah, I found it."
She stared at him, waiting, hanging on every word.
"In Berlin, I found some prepaid cards sewn into the label on a suit I left at a cleaner's. The card number led to a Google Voice line. One of the voicemail greetings referenced a web address, a hidden page on the CityForge website. There was a link to download an app called CityForge Tracker. It was location aware, but I couldn't get it to do anything."
Desmond studied Avery, seeing if she bought the lie. It was a test. Revealing the Labyrinth reality app would serve no purpose at the moment. Lying did. If she betrayed them now, they still wouldn't find the app.
"Good," she said. "We'll download it when we land. See if it works now."
They flew in silence after that, through the night. Below them lay a blanket of darkness. No vehicle headlights on the roads, no twinkling cities in the distance. Above, stars shone brightly, brighter than Peyton had ever seen on any deployment before. She couldn't help thinking back to Desmond's riddle about the absence of space junk. What did it mean? Beside her, Hannah stirred. Peyton leaned over. The young EIS agent had a fever. Was it from the gunshot wound? Peyton ran a hand over her lymph nodes. Swollen. Hannah let out a cough, then another. Peyton pulled her shirt up, revealing a small, faint rash on her abdomen.
She's infected.
Peyton's heart sank. She closed her eyes, felt them well up with tears, but she refused to let the tears break through. A hand on her shoulder, Desmond staring at her, his eyes saying, "I will fix this." She was usually the one who fixed things like this, but she needed help now. From the pilot's seat, Avery spoke over the comm.
"Coming up on something?"
Beyond the helicopter's windshield, Peyton saw a sprawling city dotted with several large bonfires. At first, the fires confused her. These people wouldn't waste wood on bonfires. Firewood was too precious in this place. They weren't connected to the grid, had no electricity. They needed firewood to cook. But a moment later, she understood. They were burning bodies. As they flew closer, she could see people piling them on the pyres by the dozens. No, hundreds. She felt sick. In the swaths of darkness between the blazes, small lights glowed. Their bears moving about like fireflies swarming the arid ground. There were dry cell battery torches, solar lanterns, and kerosene lamps, each giving off a slightly different hue, shades of white and yellow. The helicopter hovered above the scene.
"You sure about this?"
Avery asked.
"What's our fuel status?"
Desmond replied before Peyton could respond.
"Our fuel status is we're out."
Out the side window, Peyton saw crowds starting to gather, pointing up at the helicopter. Some held rifles.
"Find the main road and follow it north," she said. "There's an airstrip where it forks. The guards will be there. They'll keep us safe."
The helicopter banked, flew low over the dirt road, and found the airstrip, where a low-rise building glowed from the power of a generator. Peyton counted that as a good sign. The moment they touched down, 2 dozen figures emerged from the building and ran toward them, rifles held at the ready. Avery drew her sidearm. Desmond saw it.
"Let's stay cool here.
I'd say we're outnumbered." The men surrounded the helicopter, shouting as they closed in. Peyton scrutinized them, expecting to see Kenyan army uniforms. She didn't. They were civilians, dressed in dirty clothes. One pulled the helicopter's door open. The smell of body odor rushed in with the warm night air. Above, the helicopter's main rotor roared. Wind pushed down. Hands grabbed Peyton. They were rough, gouging into the muscles of her arms. Voices shouted in Swahili and another language she didn't know. Somali, perhaps. Desmond kicked a man reaching for him, punched another. A rifle was pressed to his face, and he froze. Peyton could hear Avery fighting too, screaming obscenities. The men dragged Peyton out, onto the ground, and held her up for a tall black man to inspect. Behind her, she heard them grabbing Hannah.
"Don't touch her!"
she yelled, but the words were lost in the commotion. Chapter 70 Peyton fought the men holding her as the helicopter's rotors thundered overhead. It took 4 large men to subdue Desmond, but they finally brought him down. They held him on the ground, twisting his arms behind him, but still he refused to cry out or to stop fighting back. The crowd of rifle-carrying militia parted, and a middle-aged black man hurried through. Whoever he was in charge. Peyton had seen him exactly once before, in a large room in Mandera filled with dying people. He had lain in a corner then, sweat covering his body, 3 buckets beside him, one for feces, one for vomit, and one for urine. That day Peyton had given him a lifeline, a dose of ZMAP. She had hoped it might cure him. It had. Dr. Elim Kibet was vibrant now, his eyes full of life. At the sight of Peyton, he yelled to one of the tall soldiers who barked orders to his men. Hands released Peyton as if she were a live electric wire. She fell forward, but Elim caught her and raised her up. Over the dying roar of the rotors, he said,
"Welcome to Dadaab, Dr. Shaw."
On Elim's orders, 2 medical technicians brought a rolling stretcher from the building and ushered Hannah inside to an operating room. The facility wasn't high tech, but it was clean and well supplied. For nearly an hour, Peyton and Alem stood over Hannah, operating. They removed dead tissue, disinfected the wound, and closed the gaping hole in Hannah's shoulder. When they were done, Peyton stood there for a long moment, staring at Hannah, hooked to the IV antibiotics and pain medication. The woman was infected with the Mandera virus, but Peyton thought she had a fighting chance now, and she was in good hands, hands that were being washed just a few feet away. Seconds later, Alem slipped out of the OR, leaving Peyton alone with Hannah. The red-headed woman was all Peyton had left of the EIS team she'd taken to the village. She imagined those young agents lying there in their tan service khakis, dead, left alone in the arid, barren land for the animals to pick over. She imagined them being found, hands running over glassy, staring eyes, bodies being zipped up in bags. It was a nightmare for her. To see someone she had deployed come home like that. She thought about them as if they were her own family, her own kids. Hannah was her only chance to save one of them. Peyton had done everything she could for her. That made her feel a bit better, a little more hopeful, for the first time since Connor McLean's men had raided the village. The camps in Dadaab were sprawling settlements. There were several camps for refugees and a smaller camp for aid agencies. Peyton and Alem had performed the surgery in the aid agency camp. During that time, there was not much for Desmond to do. With Avery at his side, he ventured out from the long single-story building that housed the aid agencies through a gate and a chain-link fence and into the refugee camps. It was good to stretch his legs. The more than 2 hours in the vibrating helicopter hadn't done his bruised body any favors. Neither had the welcoming committee who had dragged him to the ground. Several of those men stood guard by the fence, and other armed men were scattered throughout the camp. They stood next to some of the larger buildings, which had been converted to hospitals. Hospital isn't the right word, Desmond thought. They were more like convalescent camps, places where those who were expected to survive were held. The patients who were not faring as well were kept in open camps, lying on blankets and wood platforms. Screams and moans of agony sounded from every direction. Up ahead, a fire burned, consuming the bodies piled upon it. Trucks crisscrossed the camp, collecting bodies and distributing food, water, and medicine. Desmond could see that the refugees were fighting as hard as they could against the virus. He could also see that they were losing. This place was a biological meat grinder, almost too hideous for Desmond to watch. I did this, he thought. In some way, he was responsible for what was happening here, what would soon be happening around the world. In Berlin, he'd been driven to discover who he was and what had happened to him. Now he had only one desire, to stop this, to save every life he could. The look on Avery's face told him she knew exactly what he was thinking. It's not over yet, Des. We've got time to turn this around. Behind them, a man carrying an AK-47 approached.
The doctor's out of surgery. They've asked for you.
Peyton was eating dinner with Alem, Desmond, and Avery in the building's cafeteria when an African woman approached them and sat beside Alem. Peyton instantly recognized her. She was one of the survivors from the village. Was it a coincidence that she was here? The village was hundreds of miles away. How did she get to Dadaab? Alem looked exhausted, but his voice was strong.
She's a very lucky young lady.
Yes, Peyton said, taking a bite of the stew. She was glad there had been no label on the vat. A few more hours in the air and she might not have made it.
Perhaps, but she is lucky because she has you watching out for her.
Peyton had never been able to take a compliment. They seemed to wrap around her like a rope, constricting her, paralyzing her. She turned red.
Just doing my job, she said quietly, taking another bite of mystery stew. What happened here?
Biology, Alem said. The virus got loose in the camps.
How many are dead?
Alem paused.
We'll be counting the survivors when it's over, Dr. Shaw.
Any estimate would be helpful. I think this is perhaps the first large population center the virus struck, and please call me Peyton.
He nodded.
There were about 300,000 people here when this began. I expect about 10,000 to survive.
Peyton sat in shock. A 3% survival rate?
With better care, rehydration salts, the number might double. 5 or 6%,
The words hung there like a bell tolling. No one spoke for a long moment. Ebola Zaire killed 90% of those it infected. Mandera was even more deadly than that. And in its early days, it was as contagious as the common cold. It was the perfect killer. But why? How was the pandemic connected to the looking glass? What was the looking glass? What could possibly be worth killing 95% of the world's population? Or was there another plan? Connor McLean had all but confessed to having a cure to the virus. Finding that cure was the world's only chance. They needed to start putting the pieces together. Peyton swallowed. I really hate to ask. We came here for Hannah, but we were also hoping to find a couple of things. Alim raised his eyebrows. We need a sat phone. He nodded. And a plane. He broke into a smile Peyton couldn't read. She was reflecting on how outrageous the request was when he said, I think I can help you. When they finished their meal, Alim led them through the building's main corridor. The facility was in complete disarray. Every room had been ransacked. To Peyton, it looked like a middle school with no teachers, trashed by students running wild. Half-empty boxes littered the hall, desks were overturned, drawers pulled out, supply closets stood open. Alim opened a locked utility closet. The tiny room was overflowing with electronics. Cell phones, tablets, and laptops, like a vault of plastic and silicon treasures. When containment broke and everyone started getting sick, the order of this place fell quickly. There were no refugees or aid workers anymore, only survivors and the dying. The aid workers stored their electronics here, hoping they'd be of use to someone eventually. You can't use them? Desmond asked, surprised. You'll see, Alim said, a hint of dread in his voice. An African woman approached them and said, Dr. Kibet, she's awake. Hannah, Peyton thought. Avery didn't wait another second. She grabbed a laptop and a solar charger, stacked a tablet on top, then began piling cell phones up like a Jenga tower, which wobbled after a few seconds. Desmond eyed her curiously. Not sure where we're headed, the blonde said. Satellites might go out. We'll need phones from European, American, and Asian carriers on different networks. The woman always seemed to be a step ahead. Desmond collected a few phones as well. Alim pointed to a shelf where a stack of smartphones lay. Attached were the CDC-issued sat sleeves. The sight made Peyton's mouth run dry, like discovering a pile of dog tags from fallen comrades. She stared at the plastic and glass tombstones. How had they gotten here? She took two of them. One for her, one for Hannah. Desmond watched Peyton follow Alim back to the OR. He found her compassion for Hannah incredibly endearing. Peyton cared with all her heart. She had poured everything she had into caring for her young colleague, had risked her own life to save her, to bring her this far. He knew one thing. Any person on Earth would be lucky to have Peyton Shaw looking out for them. He felt Avery's eyes on him, watching him stare as Peyton left. In a way, Desmond found her to be Peyton's mirror image. They were both headstrong and determined. They cared about their mission, and they didn't let anything get in their way. Maybe that was why they clashed so much. They were too much alike. But Avery took lives. Peyton saved them. Desmond felt irresistibly drawn to both women, like a force of nature. Him a hunk of metal, them magnets exerting strong pulls in opposite directions. He found each intriguing in different ways. Each woman was a mystery he wanted to solve. When Peyton slipped out of view, Avery retreated to a conference room and closed the door. The move surprised Desmond. She wanted to be alone. Why? Ever since she'd shared her story on the helicopter, and even before that, he had questioned whether he could trust her. She could be a plant, assigned to find out where he had hidden the rendition device. Or she could be telling the truth. He pushed the door open. She had spread the phones out on the long table and was activating them. I need to check in with my handler, she said. She turned to him. You need help? He paused, debating whether to stay and see who she called. No, he said. Still torn on what to do. You're downloading the City Forge app, right? A small smile curled at her lips.
He wondered if she knew he had lied on the helicopter. He nodded, withdrew from the room, and closed the door behind him. But he stood just outside the door, waiting, hoping to hear her call. It never came. She must have been texting. He activated a cell phone and downloaded the Labyrinth Reality app. He entered the code for the private labyrinth he had created. He was asked once again whether he was the hero or the minotaur. He clicked hero. The dialogue read, "Searching for an entrance to the labyrinth." In Berlin, the application had said there were no entrances near him. He waited. Finally, a message appeared. "One entrance located." He clicked the link. A map appeared with GPS coordinates and a glowing green dot. The location was an island north of Scotland, which surprised him. It was much closer to Berlin than Dadaab. Why did the location not appear when he tried the app in Berlin? He decided the entrance must have been set to reveal on a timer, or perhaps only after some event had occurred, or perhaps when a partner activated it. That possibility intrigued Desmond the most. He zoomed in on the map dot. It was in the Shetland Islands. From the satellite photography, the place looked barely inhabited. There were some farms, a few roads, a seaport, and an airport. The glowing dot itself lay in the middle of a forest. There was no building, no home, not even a road leading to it. But he knew something was there, waiting for him. He hoped it held the key to finding a cure. Chapter 71. Hannah's eyes were open when Peyton entered the office that had been converted to a patient room. The young woman tried to sit up in bed, but Peyton told her to lie back down. Her voice came out hoarse, faint.
"What happened?"
Peyton considered what to tell her. She decided that Hannah had been through enough. Details could wait for another day.
"We were rescued."
Hannah closed her eyes, breathed heavily.
"Are we going home?"
"Eventually. I need to make a few phone calls. You're in good hands here. I'll be back." Outside the room, Peyton activated the phone and dialed Elliot's cell. The call connected without ringing.
"You've reached Operation Bioshield. If you're calling from inside a cordon zone, press 1. If you're calling from outside a cordon zone, press 2.
After a brief pause, the recording repeated. Why would Elliot's phone route to a call center? Peyton had never heard of Operation Bioshield. She wondered if it was related to the Congressional Act Project Bioshield that had called for stockpiling critical vaccines in the aftermath of 9/11. Curious, she pressed 1, indicating she was inside a cordon zone. "If you or someone in your home is sick, press 1. If you have training in an essential job role, press 2. Essential jobs include anyone with military training, doctors, nurses, police, fire, EMT, and prison employees. If you are calling from an operations center, dial 3. All other callers, press 0. Note, pressing 0 will greatly delay your wait time. The current wait time is 6 hours and 18 minutes. Peyton hung up and dialed several of her CDC colleagues. She knew only a few of their numbers by heart, but all of her calls were routed to the same Operation BioShield hotline. She dialed the CDC's Emergency Operations Center. A different recorded message played. "You've reached the BioShield Command Center. If you are transporting supplies and need destination or route assistance, press 1. If you work in an essential role and need an assignment, press 2. If you have located unsorted individuals outside a cordon zone, press 3. The last option chilled Peyton. Unsorted individuals. The recording repeated. There was no option for an operator. Peyton pressed 2. A man with a gruff voice said,
"Name and social security number."
She gave him the information and heard the man typing.
"Sir, I have critical information," he interrupted.
"Location?"
"Dadaab, Kenya."
A long pause.
"Your ops facility is Phillips Arena. Report there immediately for assignment."
"What?"
"Phillips Arena is located at..."
"I know where Phillips Arena is. Listen to me. I led the CDC mission to Kenya, the one that first encountered the Mandera virus."
The line was silent. She had his attention.
"I have information regarding its origin and possibly the key to finding a cure. I need to speak with the CDC."
She heard furious typing in the background.
"Best number to reach you?"
Did you hear what I just said? I know how this pandemic started and possibly how to find a cure.
I heard you, Dr. Shaw. We're getting about 100 calls per hour now from scientists and physicians who are sure they have information regarding a cure. We have a queue that a research assistant is working through. They'll have to call you back.
You're going to put my message in a queue and call me back?
Yes, ma'am.
Are you serious?
Yes, ma'am.
What's your name?
Corporal Travers, ma'am.
When this is over, Corporal, the newspapers and TV shows are going to figure out why so many people died. They'll identify turning points, when people in critical roles made the wrong calls. Moments when someone could have made a decision that would have changed the course of the outbreak and saved millions, possibly billions of lives. This is one of those moments. This is the moment when you can simply connect me to that research team or someone at the CDC. It will only take a few seconds. You can save a lot of people right now.
Sorry, ma'am, I don't even have their number.
Peyton paused, thinking.
Ma'am?
I'm still here.
Your number was blocked. I'm gonna need a good callback number.
Peyton opened the phone settings and read the number out. Travers thanked her, and Peyton said, Corporal?
Yes, ma'am?
How many messages are in this queue?
316, ma'am.
She shook her head. One last thing, Corporal. I'm the CDC's leading epidemiologist. I'm the one they sent to Kenya when we first found out about the outbreak. Maybe that's in your files, or maybe you can see my employment history. I'm close to this investigation. Whoever is seeing these messages will know who I am. They'll call me first. You need to move my message to the top of the list. Do you understand?
Do you require further assistance, ma'am?
She leaned her head back and groaned. After she'd ended the call, she activated the phone's web browser. If she could get in touch with the WHO, maybe they could connect her to the CDC. But she didn't know the WHO's number. The thought reminded her of Jonas, and seeing his number pop up on her phone a week ago in her condo. If they had split up in Kenya, would he still be alive? Had being near her put him in harm's way? She tried to focus. The WHO web address redirected to a site called EuroShield. The page prompted her to enter her information so she could receive the address of a local Eurocordon Center. The site asked questions nearly identical to those asked by the American operator. Europe apparently had a similar pandemic disaster protocol. She tried navigating to several more websites, but the only sites that ever came up were BioShield in America, EuroShield in Europe, and similar sites in Asia and Russia. Clearly, whatever had happened in America had also occurred around the world, almost simultaneously. Phones and internet had been routed, contained. Peyton wondered if it was the dawn of a new dark age, or perhaps something even worse. She found Desmond outside the cafeteria, staring at a smartphone, leaning against the wall. Did you find it? She asked.
Yeah, he said, lost in thought.
Every web address redirects to emergency websites. Phone lines route to a call center.
The app still works, he mumbled.
The news thrilled Peyton. This could be the break they needed. And? She prompted eagerly.
They gave me a location this time, Desmond said. An island north of Scotland. It's barely inhabited.
She could see he was frustrated. Maybe he had expected something more substantial. Or maybe it was the time he had spent walking through the camp. She told him about her call with the BioShield operator. They speculated on the state of things in America, Europe, and in particular, Shetland, where the key to finding a cure could be waiting for them.
If Great Britain is locked down, they might shoot us out of the sky the minute we enter British airspace.
That's assuming, Peyton said. We can enter British airspace. Can you fly a plane? An amused smile crossed Desmond's lips.
I don't know. Can't remember. There's really only one way to know.
She studied him for a minute, unsure if he was serious.
Smiling, he said, Kidding.
That left Avery. Neither spoke her name. Peyton simply said, I don't trust her.
You don't like her.
True, I also don't trust her. Her rescue was too convenient.
Or timely.
Do you trust her? Desmond exhaled.
I'm not sure. I want to, but it's a weird thing, not knowing everything that happened to me, my true history with her. It's impossible to explain.
He looked Peyton in the eye.
I'd also like to know the rest of our history.
She said nothing.
Why won't you tell me?
It's in the past, she said quietly. He was silent for a few seconds, then took the phone from his pocket.
I need someone I can trust. I lied to Avery on the helicopter. The app I found in Berlin is actually called Labyrinth Reality. I took two identical phones. I'll keep the one without the Labyrinth app. I want you to keep the one that has the app.
Peyton looked at the screen. It says downloading. Downloading what?
I don't know. The message popped up shortly after the entrance was located.
When Peyton looked up, Avery was standing in the hall. She hadn't heard the other woman walk up. She wondered how long Avery had been there, and how much she'd heard. Desmond followed Peyton's gaze. To Avery he said,
Did you get through?
Phones are down. Web too. We're in the dark.
Peyton tucked Desmond's cell phone in her pocket. She saw Avery watching her.
Did the app work?
Avery asked Desmond. He recounted what he had learned, including the labyrinth location in Shetland, though he still pretended as though the app was something associated with City Forge.
Shetland's a long way away, Avery said. Do we have a plane?
Peyton started off down the hall.
Let's find out.
Outside the operating room, Peyton found Elim talking quietly with the villager she had seen in the mess hall.
About our other request, Peyton said.
Elim smiled. Follow me.
He led them out of the building, across the aid camp, to a single-lane runway. At the end, Peyton could make out a large plane without many windows, a cargo plane. And as her eyes adjusted to the night, she saw the unmistakable emblem of a red cross on the side.
They arrived with supplies just as the outbreak began. They didn't make it. It's yours if you can use it. Besides, there are no pilots here.
Without a word, Avery began walking across the runway toward it. Desmond shot Peyton a look that said, I'll keep an eye on her and make sure she doesn't leave without us. Peyton thanked Elim, but the man waved it off.
It's the least I could do for the woman who saved my life. I'm sure I would not have survived without Z-Map.
You don't have me to thank for that, Peyton said. A woman at the Kenyan Ministry of Health, Nia Okeke, was very convincing. She deserves the credit.
Elim nodded grimly, as if hearing the woman's name saddened him.
I'm afraid we can't take Hannah with us, Peyton said.
I expected as much. I assure you, I'll give her the very best care I can.
Peyton could see that he meant it.
I know you will. Thank you.
Back inside the building, Peyton took a deep breath before walking into Hannah's room. Elim and the woman from the village followed right behind her. Hannah lay in the bed resting, her eyes closed. Monitors showed her vitals, which Peyton was glad to see were strong. Peyton placed a hand on Hannah's shoulder.
Hannah? She paused. Can you hear me?
Hannah opened her eyes slowly.
I need to go. Elim is going to take good care of you.
Hannah nodded, thanked Elim, then looked at the woman beside him.
You're from the village, she said.
Elim translated, and the woman nodded. Elim then explained to both Hannah and Peyton,
Your colleague, Milan Thomas, brought her to Mandera.
Milan is alive!
Peyton was overjoyed at the news, but Hannah's expression suggested she was even more joyful. A tear ran down her face.
You found me in the hospital, Elim said. I was alive, but just barely. Milan and Damiria rehabilitated me.
He looked at the woman beside him.
Gave me a reason to live.
To Hannah, he added,
I've recently learned how powerful that medicine can be.
There was a long pause. Hannah reached out and took Peyton's hand. Hannah's tears were coming faster now, but she didn't cry out loud. Peyton asked the question she knew the younger woman wanted to. Where did Milan go?
Home. To Atlanta. He called someone. Elliot, I believe, was his name. His colleague arranged transport. He departed several days ago, with the two children from the village. He was taking them to the CDC in hopes they might find clues to a cure.
Peyton's mind raced. Milan taking the survivors to the CDC was a break. To Hannah, Elim said,
Milan was quite worried about everyone he had traveled here with, but he was especially worried about you.
Peyton felt Hannah squeeze her hand. Elim gave Peyton some supplies for the trip. Food, water, and just in case, he said,
medicine. Payton had been coughing, and the physician had obviously realized she was infected with the Mandera virus. The antibiotics he provided would treat any secondary infections. As Alem led her down the corridor, he said, "There's something I've wanted to ask since you arrived." She nodded. "Of course. The young American I cared for, Lucas Turner. Did he make it?" Payton shook her head. "No. I'm very sorry." "So am I. He was a fine young man. And brave." They were both silent for a moment. "Well, thank you for everything," Payton said at last. "Good luck to you, Dr. Shaw." "And to you." In the makeshift hospital room, Hannah dried the tears from her face and closed her eyes. She had never been so tired in all her life. She knew the fever was advancing, that the days ahead would determine whether she lived or died. She was ready, because now she would face it with a very valuable thing, a thing she didn't have the day before. Hope. In another patient room, Alem Kibbit injected a vial of antibiotics into the IV.
"You're wasting that on me," the woman said.
Despite her deteriorating condition, her tone was firm, insistent. Alem had to agree with Dr. Shaw. Nia Okeke was a very convincing woman when she wanted to be.
"You know," he said, "for your sake, it's a good thing you are not the physician in charge here."
The plane was similar to the Air Force transport Payton had come to Kenya on, except a bit smaller. The crew cabin held 6 high-backed chairs and an open space where Payton found Desmond stretched out on a sleeping bag. He wore only boxers and a t-shirt, which had sweat spots coming through. He was still in great shape, with broad shoulders and the build of someone who did kickboxing or weight training, not yoga or endurance running. The burn scars that covered his feet and stretched up his legs caught her eye, and she remembered the first time she saw them, almost 20 years ago, that morning in her dorm room. That felt like a lifetime ago. Yet here and now, he was somehow more like that happy 19-year-old kid than he was like the troubled adult he had become after. Just like that night at the Halloween party, she felt herself irresistibly drawn to him, like a black hole that was pulling her in with no hope of escape. She had felt the first spark when she heard his voice the previous Saturday night, and again when Lucas Turner had said his name. And when she had seen his name written on the wall of the barn stall, it had been Desmond who had rescued her from the ship and likely saved Hannah's life in the process. At each point, a little more of her had come alive, like she was waking up from a long sleep. But she couldn't allow that to happen. They had work to do. Lives were at stake, things far more important than her and Desmond. She settled into a sleeping bag beside him, and they lay in silence. She could feel him looking at her. She wondered what he was thinking, when he would remember, if he would remember, and what she would do then. 5 minutes later, the plane lifted off, en route to Shetland. Despite the noise and turbulence, Desmond fell asleep quickly. "He must be exhausted," Payton thought. The temperature in the cabin dropped as the plane climbed. The engines roared. Avery was pushing the craft to its limits. Payton tucked a few pillows between Desmond and the wall, cushioning him in case they hit more turbulence. Then she slid back into her own sleeping bag and pulled in close beside his, trapping the heat between them. Slowly, she became more aware of her fever. Perhaps it was the chill in the cabin or the solitude, but the heat engulfed her face. Her head ached. Her chest felt heavy. She really hoped they found some clue on the island, for her sake and many others. Desmond mumbled, but Payton couldn't hear what he said over the roar of the engines. She turned. His eyes were still closed. He spoke again. She leaned in, her ear inches from his lips. "I figured it out," he paused, then mumbled, "the X Factor." Payton remembered the memory. She had been there, and she knew what came next. She dreaded it for him. She drew out the phone he'd given her. A dialogue read, "Download complete." Day 10. 4,600,000,000 infected. 1,000,000 dead. Chapter 72. By the time the Red Cross plane leveled out, sweat was pouring off of Desmond.
Peyton had unzipped his sleeping bag, but it was little help. Every few seconds, he tossed his head from side to side. Peyton tried to wake him for 5 minutes straight, but it was no use. It was as if he were in a coma. She heard footsteps behind her, turned, and found Avery towering above her, squinting at Desmond, wincing on the floor. The slender woman squatted, wiped the sweat from his forehead, and cupped his face in her hands. She leaned close, listening to the words he mumbled. It struck Peyton as a lover's embrace, not a clinical inspection. She wondered if it was an act, or something Avery had actually done before. Without turning to Peyton, Avery said, "Should we land?" "I don't know, where are we?" "Over Ethiopia." "He's stable for now. I favor waiting until we reach Europe." Avery left without another word. As soon as the door to the cockpit closed, Peyton wiped a new layer of sweat from Desmond's face and placed her hands where Avery's had been, feeling the stubble on his lean, glistening face. All she could do now was wait. 2 days after Christmas, in Peyton's apartment, Desmond presented his theory to her. "I figured it out."
"What, the meaning of life?"
"Better. Why companies fail."
"Oh."
She was reading People magazine and watching reruns of Friends. "It's the X Factor."
"I don't follow."
"Think about it. First, the company has to address a large market opportunity." He was pacing in the small apartment now, cutting off her view of Ross and Rachel. "XTV got that right. But success requires two components, operational proficiency and the X Factor. For all these web startups, the operational part is actually the easiest. You make sure your code works and the product scales, you pay your rent, etc., etc. The X Factor is the issue. For web companies, the X Factor is consumer adoption. Every one of them is disrupting the world in some way. They're trying to change customer behavior. Think about it. Amazon wants to change the way we buy books. Instead of walking into a Barnes & Noble, you order it online and it arrives at your door. Who knows, maybe they'll deliver all kinds of stuff one day. Webvan wants to deliver groceries in the same way, no more driving to the store. Webcrawler wants to change the way we find information. Forget going to a library and looking it up, simply search for it on Webcrawler. Need to find a business? Don't dial 411, forget the yellow pages, just search for it on Webcrawler. They're all trying to change the way we as consumers behave, and funnel attention and money to them.
Makes sense.
The mystery is how many consumers will change and when. That's what XTV got wrong. They overestimated consumer adoption. They ran out of money before the consumers adopted their product.
Okay, I'll buy that.
She was peeking around him. Monica had just inherited a dollhouse. How this show was so popular was a mystery to Desmond. "It comes down to the founders," he said. "Companies that succeed have a founder or a leadership team that fundamentally understands their customers, sometimes even better than customers know themselves. They imagine what the customer wants before they know they want it, and they package it in a way that is irresistible. And they manage well. XTV had the vision, but not the discipline. They didn't watch their bank account close enough."
"Uh-huh.
So what are you going to do about this grand revelation?" "Tomorrow I'm going for 3 job interviews."
"Really?"
She sat up, tossed the magazine aside.
"Where?"
He told her, and she nodded.
"You gonna wear the steel-toed boots?"
"Very funny. And yes, I am, because I keep it real." On New Year's Eve, he accepted a job offer. When he told Peyton which company, she looked surprised.
"Cynet?"
"Cynet. I didn't see that coming." The company was boring. It was early stage in developing an e-commerce platform to sell scientific equipment and products. "It's a home run," Desmond said. "Low X factor. Very little waiting for consumer adoption. Their customers are scientists and office admins. Very rational people. Easy to target. Very easy to predict their behavior patterns."
"Don't be so sure. I was raised by a scientist."
"Well, you know what I mean. They'll hit it out of the park. Won't be a multi-billion dollar company, but it'll succeed and do what I need it to do."
"Which is?"
"Provide financial security. The job offer's solid, tons of options and a good salary. I can start buying options in other companies again."
"So you haven't given up on that?"
"Not by a long shot." They went to a New Year's Eve house party that night. It was like no New Year's Desmond could remember.
The whole world felt new again. He felt hopeful about everything. The new job, and his relationship with Peyton especially. The vibe at Cynet was very different from XTV. Where XTV had an almost Hollywood feel, Cynet felt like a university or a lab. Everyone was pretty uptight. Well, everyone except for a few of the developers, Desmond included. They couldn't help but make a few pranks to lighten the mood. Most were related to the movie The Terminator, in which an artificial intelligence called Skynet becomes self-aware and tries to wipe out humanity with a robotic Arnold Schwarzenegger. Whenever the database or website was acting weird, someone would say, "Oh God, I think Skynet's becoming self-aware." The site's error page featured a picture of Arnold Schwarzenegger wearing dark sunglasses and holding a shotgun with a caption that read, "This page has been terminated." The CEO finally sent an email banning all jokes related to the Terminator. Desmond replied, "Just to confirm, these jokes are terminated?" Despite their faux fears that Cynet would become self-aware, the platform did launch in the spring of 1998 and quickly became a hit. Across the country, labs and research facilities signed up, took inventory of the old equipment collecting dust, and posted it for sale. Some used the money to buy more equipment they actually needed, much of it from Cynet. Desmond was the lead developer. He could have taken the role of chief technology officer, but he'd rated that job as more risky. He would have had a higher salary with fewer technical responsibilities. If the company ran low on cash or needed to refocus, he figured managers with higher pay would be laid off more quickly than the programmers who would be needed to right the ship. For the time being, however, the ship was sailing quite well. Their first clients were in the Bay Area. Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, NASA's Ames Research Center, Stanford, and SRI International. Word spread among scientists and procurement departments. Signups and transactions soared. Desmond periodically ran database reports for management, identifying their largest clients, organizations they should call on and keep happy. Some were companies he'd never heard of. Rapture Therapeutics, Rook Quantum Sciences, and Prometheus Technologies. "These three companies are each buying more than Livermore, Stanford even," he said. "And it's all kinds of stuff. They're either just stocking up, or they're running the largest scale experiments in the world." Cynet CEO was in his early 30s, had an MBA from Harvard, and was all business. "I fail to see a problem with any of that." "Well," Desmond said, "the issue is that Rapture and Rook in particular aren't paying for their equipment. I can see the credit card transactions on the back end. They're using cards and bank accounts tied to two companies, Sitium Holdings and Invisible Sun Securities." The CEO was getting annoyed. So? "We have two third-party companies buying massive amounts of scientific equipment and shipping it to these legitimate private research firms. Again, how is that a problem?" "I'm not sure it is, but I think we ought to look into it. We've created something new here. What if someone's taking advantage of it? What if Cynet is being used to launder money somehow? Like Mexican drug cartels, the mafia?" "Okay, Desmond. I think you've been watching too much TV. We've got what we need here." Management was in no hurry to question their best clients. The company needed the transaction volume, and Sitium Holdings and Invisible Sun Securities were providing plenty of it. But Desmond couldn't contain his curiosity. He looked the companies up. Both were dead ends. They didn't seem to exist beyond a few corporate records. There were no offices, no websites, not even phone numbers. They were like shells with seemingly endless amounts of cash. Another mystery, closer to home, did get solved. Peyton was going to attend Stanford Medical School. She told him at her apartment one night, over dinner, lasagna she had cooked that was the best meal he had eaten in some time. "That's great," he said. "It's nearly impossible to get in." "I was worried, honestly." "I'll do whatever I can to help you." "I know you will. It's why I wanted to stay here in the area. I don't want us to be apart. We have to start thinking about the future." The words "we" and "us" hung there in the air, present but unacknowledged. Peyton used those words more often after that. She talked about the future more frequently. She asked whether he wanted to have kids, where he wanted to live, in the city, a suburb, or the country, as he had done growing up. What sort of life he wanted his children to have. What he thought work-life balance should be for people with kids. Whether he wanted to travel if they had the chance. Desmond found himself utterly unable to answer her questions. As the months went by, she began to apply more pressure, subtle at first, then more directly. Desmond's answer was always the same, that he was so focused on work at the moment that it was hard for him to imagine these scenarios. It's like a train in a tunnel. You don't know what's on the other side. How can you say what you'll do when you come out? That set her off. You're not a train in a tunnel, Desmond. We're real people. It's not hard to imagine. But for Desmond, it was impossible. Throughout his entire life, he'd always been at the mercy of someone, or something else. The fire, Orville, Silicon Valley. And now he wanted independence, freedom. That meant money. And once he had it, he believed he could sort his life out. Then he could answer Peyton's questions, which haunted him more and more. With each month, he saw the prospect of financial freedom slipping away. Four more companies he owned options in folded. Cynet's rate of growth slowed. The initial rush was over. Those storage closets full of old equipment had been cleaned out, and now the users were spending less per month. Management came up with several ideas, expanding to Europe and using the platform to help industrial companies buy and sell equipment. Both presented new challenges. Then in the summer of 98, everything changed. A company Desmond owned options in went public. He only held 13,400 options, but they were worth $21 at the IPO price, which meant, all told, they were worth $250,000. He checked the stock price about 1,000 times the day it debuted, fearing the worst, a crash or some freak accident. But just the opposite happened. The stock soared. By the end of the first day of trading, his options were worth $38.23 each. $512,282. The sum was nearly unimaginable to him. A fortune. Freedom. He raced to Wallace's office. The attorney connected him with an investment bank that would help him unload the options, ensuring the profits were taxed at long-term capital gains rates. Are you sure you want to sell all of it, Desmond?
I'm sure.
Desmond had come up with a rubric for deciding whether to keep or sell a stock. If he was willing to buy the stock at its current price, he would keep it. Otherwise, he would sell. He wanted the cash. The transaction went through the next day, netting him just over $400,000 after taxes and fees. He again sat in Wallace's office.
I need you to draw up some other agreements, personal contracts.
He told the men exactly what he wanted.
She'll have to sign them, Desmond.
I know. It won't be a problem.
You're a brilliant young man, but I think you've got a lot to learn about women.
Desmond's will was the easiest part. In classic Orville Hughes fashion, it read, To Peyton Adelaide Shaw, I leave everything. The other forms were a series of assignment agreements that gave Peyton ownership of half of all the options and securities he owned. That night they celebrated the IPO with a dinner out. After dessert, Desmond showed her the will, which, to his surprise, sort of freaked her out.
I just want you to be taken care of, he said. What if I fell over dead, got hit by a car?
Don't say that, Desmond.
It's true. You're all I've got, Peyton. You're the only person in my life I'm really close to.
Really close to? Is that how you'd describe us? She chugged the rest of her wine. This conversation hadn't gone the way he'd planned. He had thought she'd be relieved. At her apartment, he showed her the assignment agreements that gave her half of all his stock and options.
It's what's fair, he said.
You saved me, Peyton, when I wanted to put it all in XTV. You introduced me to the first people I bought options from. You've been the only constant in my life since I've been in California. You practically supported me after XTV, kept me from starving. You've been my partner in this whole thing, and you should have half.
She exploded.
Your partner? Is that what we are? Business associates? Is that all this is?
No, Peyton.
Then what are we?
What do you want from me?
You know exactly what I want.
He did know. It wasn't stock options or any written agreement. It was three words he couldn't seem to say. After a few months, she had stopped saying them.
but he could tell when she wanted to. That hurt him, too. "Will you please sign them?" he said.
"Get out. Peyton, you heard me. And take all your legal documents with you."
Peyton didn't return his calls or emails for 2 weeks. They were the longest weeks of Desmond's life. He also had problems at work. Cyanet was nearly out of money. They arrived at a seemingly counterintuitive solution. Go public. The IPO, if successful, would raise over $50 million for the company. It would also make Desmond rich. He watched in wonder as the finance department dressed up the books. Management asked him for endless reports, cutting and shuffling the data for the roadshow. There were all sorts of disclosures and disclaimers in the prospectus, verbiage about the risks to their business and things outside their control. But those dense sections weren't what investors saw. They stared at the graphs on the projection screen that showed rapid growth and read the parts that described a company with massive profit potential. Cynet entered its quiet period and waited. Every person in the company was on edge. To Desmond, it felt like being trapped in a submarine at war, knowing there were mines floating everywhere in the water around them, the entire crew holding its breath, waiting to see if they would hit one and sink, or if they would make it out to freedom as heroes. Every day, Desmond wrote another email to Peyton. When she didn't reply, he camped out at her front door. He was nervous that the neighbors would call the police, but they must have had some sense of what was going on. They looked at him with sympathy as they passed. One guy said, "Good luck, buddy." When Peyton opened the door that morning, she tried to slam it in his face, but he held it open. "Please just talk to me."
"You talk, I'll listen."
She stood in the living room, hands on her hips. "I want you to try to imagine things from my perspective." She was a statue. "There's something broken inside me, deep down inside, in a place I never knew existed before I met you. I never needed it before, because anyone who ever loved me was ripped out of my life before I could love them back. I watched my family burn to death. I was raised by one of the meanest guys I've ever known. He never loved me. I don't think he could, or maybe he couldn't show it. I never knew love as a child. I've never known it before, until I met you. I don't know what to do or how to feel, because this is completely new to me. I care about you more than anything I've ever cared about in this world. You're my whole life, Peyton. But you need to know that I'm not a whole person. I'm not the person you want me to be." The tears began streaming down her face. She put her arms around him, pulled him close, and pressed her body tightly into his. He could feel the tension drain out of his body, the release, the void filled with a desperate hunger. His body